the Minister in Law, Gall, has been held every year in Viterbo at Latuscia University. A theme is specified for each year and a call for papers is issued to invite scholars from around the world to submit paper proposal. The proposals are chosen by a special committee, and then sometimes they are also published in important international journal. In the past seminar, we can identify three major threads. The first involves a discussion of general characteristics of global administrative law, for example, on global administrative law and global governance, the theme of the first seminar. The second thread is in specific institutions of global administrative law, for example, that regarding a legality review, the subject of the fifth seminar, or the participation of the private actors in global administrative law, the theme of the third seminar. And the third and the last thread is one in which relevant themes regarding the conceptual tools that are particularly important for understanding global administrative law are analyzed in detail. For example, the sixth seminar was devoted to the financial crisis and the global regulatory governance. The theme that will be developed today and tomorrow in this eighth edition of Viterbo seminars, that of indicators in global governance, the legal dimension, fits nicely, therefore, into this tradition of a collective reflection and discussion. Some quick points about how our work will be organized. This afternoon, we have two working sessions. The first is on a governance by indicators, the second on global health and human rights indicators. Each session will open with the presentation of the paper by each author. Each of them will have available not more than 7-8 minutes, and group of papers then will receive comments from a discussant who will be allowed not more than 10-12 minutes, and as chair I will have the job of making sure we respect the times assigned to each one. Then we have an open discussion for anyone who would like to make comments. At 4:30 we have also a coffee break. Some thanks to the institution that have promoted the organization of this seminar, the University of Tusha, Institute of Research and Public Administration, IRPA, the Lewis School of Government, the New York University School of Law. A thank you to the institutions that have contributed to the organization and the funding of this seminar. Of course, at the Aspen, and then to IFAD, ENI, Formats, and Cleary Gottlieb Studio. Then, we can begin. The first paper, Benedict Kingsbury, Indicators and the Law in Global Governance.
Well, my opportunity as the first of the visitors, I think, is to speak for everybody who's come to this lovely place, all the participants, the speakers, the discussants, and thanking very much Professor Tremonti and the Aspen Institute for hosting us in such a spectacular setting, and to Giulio Vesperini and his group of the Italian hosts and planners of this meeting, and Sabino Cassese. I think speaking on behalf of everybody, we have, I think, 25 papers and several discussants. It probably is not necessary for each person to make a nice speech of thanks in their 7 minutes. So although it's polite, and Italy is a very polite society, you can skip the politeness if you want to and just get on with your paper. The other speakers, that is. The American writer Henry James, in his evocative essay on Venice in 1882, later became the opening chapter in the Italian Hours collection, was remarking on the way in which Venetians drew sustenance from the beauty of their setting, the town, the sun, the sea, despite having decayed habitations, heavy taxes, light pockets, few opportunities, and many of them malnourished. It takes a great deal, said James, to make a successful American. But to make a happy Venetian takes only a handful of quick sensibility. The Italian people, he said, have at once the good and the evil fortune to be conscious of few wants, so that if the civilization of a society is measured by the number of its needs, as seems to be the common opinion today, it is to be feared that the children of the lagoon would make but a poor figure in a set of comparison tables. So that's Henry James in 1882 already treating international rankings as normal, indeed as a perfectly proper way to understand material wealth, comparatively. But James is also saying that to understand life that way would be to miss a great deal of what we really need to know to understand a real human setting and values such as beauty or indeed civilization. So I mentioned that encapsulation of the indicator's dilemma, partly because it reminds us also that this topic of indicators is a convergence point of intellectual reflection and practical polities and politics, dealing with culture, society, economy, as Professor Tremonti has said. As we'll see in this conference, indicators bear directly on education policy, health policy, refugees, migration, economic management. That range of topics is very much like the range of the Aspen Institute, which has sponsored and supported important initiatives in all of those areas, locally, Italy, United States, globally, for many, many decades. So I feel especially fitting for this topic to be one which the Aspen Institute is hosting, and it's a pleasure to be working together. This topic of indicators also is here treated today in our conference, especially from a legal point of view, through the inspired group of scholars Sabino Cassese has led and nurtured in Global Administrative Law that Giulio has introduced already. So it's a pleasure for us at NYU to be once again collaborating with that group in this Italian-American cooperation. And we'll hope that even a group of lawyers have a lot of interesting things to say about a broad topic. Now, Kevin Davis, who's here, my colleague Sally Engel-Merry, anthropologist, who's unfortunately not here, Angelina Fisher, who is here, and me, have together been working on this in NYU. There's a new book coming out next month from Oxford University Press, and several of the people in the room have chapters in this book. It's called Governance by Indicators, and this is the bound proofs. We've got a few copies here, which please don't take them away, but we'll leave them these 2 days if you want to have a look at them, and the book itself will be published next month. And if you're in desperation, we can probably send you a PDF or something. Or if you're impoverished by circumstance. So in that framing paper for the book, which is recently published as a paper and it's largely reproduced in the introduction of the book, Kevin Davis, Sally Murray, and I tried to define indicators. Several of the papers later in the conference refer to that definition. Some points we focused on in thinking what's special about indicators, about this form of governance by information as a form of power. The idea that there's a name for an indicator, that there are rankings, so that they're expressed numerically as simplifications, the simplification of more complicated raw data. This idea of being commensurable, that is, that you compare one to another directly by the commonality of the indicator position. And the possibility then of using the indicator for evaluation against some standard. Now, there are other things to say, but what we have in mind when we talk about indicators are things which have those characteristics. Now, of course, many indicators are actually aggregations. They're so-called mashups from different pieces of granular data, and you can mash them up in any way you want. So it's a feature of indicators that the barriers to entry are often quite low to produce one. Whether you can produce a good one is another problem. So with those general features of indicators, our starting point in the book and in our work has been that they're a significant form of power, that they worked in ways which transform how power works locally in the state, globally. They may increase the power of the people who can produce indicators, the people who can establish them, vis-a-vis others who can get decisions, flows of funds, market ratings and things to flow with them. So they have a significant effect in power, and it's increasing. And they're a form of knowledge. And one of the ways in which they have power is by constructing knowledge, by creating concepts, discrediting other concepts. So that's why we think, from a legal point of view, it's important to study indicators. And that's, of course, the unifying dimension of this conference. Now, we can think a little about the relations between indicators and law, in a context where we have a lot of lawyers, as well as many other people, gathered to reflect on this phenomenon. So I'm going to make it a very quick list of 10 points where we can see some connections between indicators and law, just to get our discussion started. The first is that indicators function much like norms, standards, much like written rules do, even without any claim to be law. How's that? First, they embody an ideal of what a good society could be. What would be a good situation? What could be the best of this? Second, and within that, they often have a theory of causation of what is going to produce that good society. We're going to measure the things. The better you are in them, the more you're going on the right track, or the reverse. Third, they often have an implicit theory of the solution. If there's a problem, if they're diagnosing a problem, then they have in them the idea of how that could be solved. So in that respect, they're much like purpose of deliberately made law, but without any of the usual processes of control that we apply to lawmaking. No requirements of consultation, of legislative approval, of extended deliberation, of voice for the voiceless. So they're like law, but without all those special requirements we've put for law over time. So that's my first and biggest point about the basic similarity there. Second, though, that indicators simultaneously articulate the standard and they apply it to concrete cases. They announce the standard and they rank each country or each unit at the same moment as they announce it. Third, with some indicators, there's a significant flow of costs and benefits attached to the ranking. That's what we'll see with credit ratings, for example, which we'll discuss shortly. Fourth, is there's often a symbiosis between the producer of the indicator and the subject of it, the indicated. They're mutually dependent. Companies pay credit rating agencies to be rated. They need each other, much like regulators and regulated are symbiotic. Fifth, we can use indicators as part of a legal regulatory process to supervise a legal standard or to implement it. We see that, for example, in the papers we have on public health, on the breast milk substitutes code and otherwise indicators giving details to make a law work. Sixth, we can use indicators in the same way as we use law as expressive, as a way of expressing values, expressing political commitments. They may be neoliberal, they may be liberal human rights, they may be something quite different, but we can use indicators to do those things. Seventh, more economic terms, an indicator, especially if it's highly authoritative and stable over time, can be a focal point around which expectations align once it's established. So we might say that the World Bank Group's Doing Business Indicators, Freedom House's Freedom in the World Indicator, the World Economic Forum Global Competitiveness Index, the State Department's, US State Department's Trafficking in Persons Indicator, all operate as a kind of focal point around which expectations converge. In some cases, the legal regime intensifies the significance of the indicator as a focal point, and that's true of the legal structure which requires letter-graded bond ratings, AA minus, etc. Those requirements are now set into law, and a lot of other things depend through law and through market practice on that indicator practice. All right, my eighth point now, that some of the ways in which indicators influence expectations, social categories, behavior, status, identities are very similar to the way in which law influences those same things. Naming and shaming, praising, blaming, emulation, acculturation, using information to change beliefs. All of those things are pathways in which law works in society and globally, and we see indicators working in exactly the same kind of ways. My ninth point, very briefly, is that indicators seem to have more influence in some situations in the same way that international law has more in some particular kinds of situations, and they may be the same situations. So some research shows that human rights treaties had the most influence not on dictatorships, which don't care, not on successful democracies, which don't need them, but on fading dictatorships, fading authoritarian states, or fledgling democracies. And we see indicators, say, of rule of law in Central Europe having had their big moment of influence in exactly the same time after the communist transition. And my final point, then, is that when we see all of these similarities, points of difference, we would expect that we could use indicators, and we'll find them used strategically in ways which are deliberately connected to law. So they can complement law, adding more. They can be coupled with law, simply to enforce the law, using public indicators saying the same thing as the rule. But also, and this is where I'm going to end, an indicator can be a substitute for law. If you can't get a law made, you just publish an indicator. Don't worry about all the political obstacles, get your indicator out. Indicators can be used to undercut law. You don't like the legal rule, you use an indicator to challenge it. So we could say, for example, that when the World Bank, doing business indicators, gave countries a higher ranking if it was easy to fire workers, that was a deliberate undercutting of the ILO conventions, which tried to solidify a particular form of workers' rights. The World Bank couldn't change the ILO conventions, but they could publish a very influential indicator, which really undercut that. And earlier this year, Vladimir Putin made a speech, not about ILO conventions, not about nice international treaties, but about how Russia was going to be in the top 20 in the doing business indicators in his administration. So with that sense of indicators and their relations to law, I think we are on the right track for a very exciting conference on that topic.
Thank you. I forgot to specify an important aspect that regarding the papers that are presented in these 2 days. In part, they are selected from the usual procedure, the call for papers selection. But on the other hand, however, the papers that will be discussed today and tomorrow are by specialists on the theme that we'll be dealing with, and whom we asked to present us with their research. Then we, of course, we haven't selected Benedict's paper, but at the opposite, Benedict is one of the pioneers of this theme, and he gave us this idea. Then the second paper from Christian Hart, The Politics of Global Rankings. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and thank you for the invitation. I will express myself here in my personal capacity. I'm working at the OECD, but anything I say is not necessarily the view of the organization I'm working at. So when I listen to Benedict's presentation, I hear that indicators become more and more important, and we have already heard that they have already been important even 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago, that people like to rank themselves, they like to benchmark themselves against each other. I will focus in this presentation on the cross-country comparable indicators. There's a large demand for comparing countries, for comparing the policies of governments, for comparing outcomes. And I would like to contrast the demand with the supply that exists and then see how, if there is a gap, how this gap could be bridged potentially. So there's a demand for hard facts. That's what I always hear. We don't want just some blah, blah, blah. We would like to have hard facts. There's a demand coming from governments, there's a demand coming from international organizations, from researchers, from the media, from businesses, investors, and NGOs. If, for instance, I make a presentation, I myself working on regulatory reform issues, if I make a presentation and say, and put out all the good reasons why it would be useful to invest in regulatory reform, and I do this in front of policymakers, they may just look at me and not really interested in it. The moment we put up a chart which shows that if you improve on this and this indicator of regulatory policy by this and this, then the gross dividend will be such, and we say that this might be backed up by evidence, there's much more interest. So there's a demand for, and I'm not saying that these are facts, but there's a demand for facts. There's a demand for performance indicators. There's a demand for moving from process indicators more to an outcome focus. Policymakers want to know more about the actual impact. Impact needs to be demonstrated, and ideally impact needs to be demonstrated on the things that matter, the big things like growth and welfare, etc. There's a demand for indicators that cover a lot of countries compared to indicators that just cover a few countries. At the same time, there's a demand for indicators that take the context of each country into account, which obviously can be a little bit contradictory in some cases. There is a demand for indicators that track progress over time. There's a demand for indicators that are simple, very simple, one number, not too complex, not too much information, just give me one number. The world is already complex enough, I just want one number. As I said, there's also a demand for communication. In order to get into The Economist, Financial Times with a topic, you need to come up with a nice ranking, otherwise it will be difficult. There's a demand for indicators to create incentives, which links up also to what Benedict was saying, which is a kind of also a lawmaking process, make people change their behaviors, make states change their policies. There's a demand to monitor, there's a demand to allocate money, there's a demand for naming and shaming. There's a demand for indicators to put a topic on the agenda. Now, there's a lot of demand here. The question is, where are these miracle indicators that can actually match this demand? Now, if I look at the supply side, I can look at it from two perspectives. I can look at from the perspective of academics looking at the supply side and seeing, do the indicators that are actually used, are they being used in the correct way, and do they match the expectations? And I can look at it is, how do the people who are using the indicators actually understand them? Now, if I look at the indicators that are used, interestingly, in the past, there has been a huge rise in the number of indicators and also an improvement in the quality of a lot of those indicators. But those indicators that are the most widely used are exactly those that match the demand of the decision makers, which basically is indicators which just summarize all of this information ideally into one number, so not too much complexity. And these indicators do not always match what they are supposed to be doing, because, for instance, if we look at issues of comparability over time, or comparability across countries, comparability or across countries is not easy to achieve if you have 200 countries. If we look, for instance, at Transparency International's Corruption Index or the World Bank World Governance Indicator's Control of Corruption Indicator, which is a kind of a mashup in this index of a lot of different expert assessment and perception surveys, some of these, for instance, ask questions to experts, is corruption high in your country? Now, obviously, it's not always the same experts which you ask, and they may have a different benchmark in their mind. If you're in one African state and you compare yourself to your neighbor, it's different than comparing yourself to Switzerland. That may give a different number. Now, if different experts have in their head a different benchmark, obviously you can get some problems. And that links me to conceptual issues. There are some people who actually say that measurement in certain areas, particularly linked to governance, actually measurement came before understanding. And I remember when these indicators came up that were summarizing the information from different sources and came up with country rankings for almost all countries in this world, people were saying, People always said we can't measure this, but we can actually. So it has been demonstrated. But it wasn't so clear, and that leads me to the next point on what it is that was actually measured. So one of the biggest demands is for indicators is to change behavior. For instance, in the era of corruption, may just stick to that example, that countries become less corrupt. Now, on the indicators that are usually used for aid allocation decision, investment decisions, it's very difficult to know what a country should change their rating, because it's often perception surveys, it's very broad question, as I said, so to change this is not always obvious. So there's not a concrete action which is behind it. Now, even in some cases where it's clear what you need to do to change the score on an indicator, it doesn't always mean that this is always useful. In particular, if indicators become more and more important in the allocation of resources for the career of people, etc., there is quite some incentive for gaming. And I mean, there are classic examples here. I mean, for instance, let's just give one example. If in a country it's very important for policemen, for their advancement, that the crime rates go down, crime rate seems to be something very objective. But at the same time, you could also imagine that individuals could ask people or try to convince people who come and would like to declare a crime, try to convince them not to declare and say that doesn't make a difference anyway, etc. So this is also a way for making crime rates go down and making a country or making particular police stations look better in a ranking. And I mean, that's pretty well known in similar other areas, like, for instance, hospitals, waiting time before in the emergency room, that then just ambulances waited outside so that the waiting time in the waiting room would go down. This is quite well demonstrated in the literature. So we're a little bit in this conundrum that not, and you're probably familiar with what Einstein said, is that not everything that counts can be counted, and not everything that can be counted counts. So in this world where everyone would like to summarize this very complex reality in a number, we have to face certain trade-offs, and it's not possible to come up with this magic number. It's not because no one has been intelligent enough to come up with something fantastic. I think we just have to live with certain trade-offs in the indicators business. There is the issue of, for instance, measuring the de jure situation versus the de facto situation. It's much more straightforward to achieve cross-country comparability over time, etc., with so-called de jure indicators, where you, for instance, look at formal requirements that are in place in countries. It's easier to define, and it's also more action-oriented. In this case, it's much more easier for countries to know, okay, I as a government can change my score by changing the law in my country. But of course, then, this does not always necessarily mean that this proxy is representing what you actually really would like countries to change, because in particular in developing countries, we have seen a lot of changes in the formal system and not so much changes in the reality, in the informal systems. But then on the other side, if you look more at outcomes and de facto and what's actually happening, in most cases, you need to rely much more on expert assessment, perceptions, etc. So you get a much higher element of subjectivity and much more difficulties in comparing this across countries and potentially over time. I mean, obviously, there's some exceptions. There's some outcome indicators, like from Reporters Without Borders, number of journalists killed, etc. Put aside the measurement issues that you do not always get that information from all the countries. In some cases, you can have facts-based outcome indicators, but most of the time, you actually need to rely on experts. Also, the more you move towards what really matters, the more you have the issue of attribution. I can just give a practical example from the area I'm working in. We are encouraging countries to set up one-stop shops to make it easier and quicker for countries for businesses to start up a business. But even there, if we then measure the number of, if there has been an increase in business startups, that can also be due to the economic situation, etc. So there are always all these issues. So we, another important aspect is that people often do not understand the indicators. Sometimes they obviously do not want to understand them. I mean, if I'm a researcher and I would like to run some nice fancy regressions, then do I take the indicators data set, which has 200 countries coverage, where I can run my fancy panel data models? Do I really would like to look into all the problems with it? Or do I just take it and maybe focus on other issues? But there's also often the problem that for a lot of the most widely used indicators and also for other indicators, it's really hard to get the information. Even in cases where all the underlying data and information is out there, it's not always drafted in, maybe let's use a term from the legal language, in plain language. And it's very easy to impress people with some very complicated calculations and tests and words from statistics and econometrics and say, all this is robust because I did all of this and using words that no one really understands. I've seen this a lot in conferences because there's not much questioning if someone comes up with something very complicated. And it would be very difficult for other people to explain what might be wrong with these calculations to a non-expert audience. Now, what to do? I think what's very important is exactly the kind of conferences that we have here now, because it's very important that academia plays a role in here. I think it's important, first of all, that for any kinds of indicators that there's a clear normative framework and there's a role for academia to debate that framework. To be aware of limitations of indicators, be transparent about it, and ideally rely on different types of indicators. To invest in data quality. It seems obvious. I mean, I think if I say invest in data quality, it seems obvious. But, I mean, even in my day-to-day work, because I'm working on indicators, I'm leading a program on measuring regulatory performance, it's very hard to convince people to give money for good indicators. It's very hard. There's a demand for it, but there's not necessarily much understanding of how much energy it takes. I mean, in our data set, I have 200 questions in there, one of them just being on whether the law and subordinate regulations are easily accessible to the public. Now, in order to really compare countries on this, I would need lawyers who really look into all the databases that are there, if they are well-designed, etc. But that obviously costs money. So how can we convince those who have the money to put that money, make that money actually available for good data quality? There might also be the idea of investing in standards in the soft area. I mean, there are a lot of standards out there for indicators in general, but maybe not that much for governance indicators. And for an education of leaders and decision makers and policy makers. Because what I'm seeing a lot is those that make the decisions are usually not familiar even with very basic indicator methodology. I hear so often we want to have indicators because they're objective. And I think it's very important that there is more of an education and understanding and questioning of any of the assumptions behind that.
Thank you so much. Then we have the first discussant, David Nelken. Thank you.
I'm not allowed to say thank you, but I'm allowed to feel it. I've been involved in this conference for the first time, getting to know what wonderful work's been done on this fantastic subject. I've been involved, I assume, because I'm a sociologist of law, and I bring that background to looking at the question that must be behind many of these case studies, but they can get put on one side when one's doing a particular case study and all its rich historical or contemporary detail, and which is, are we talking about law here, or are we talking about information? So my title is Law as Information. At the first sight, they would seem to be very different things. Information is one thing, law is another. Information is useful, can be acted on by regulators. We need to know the result of law, but why call it law? And in the two very sophisticated papers that we've heard, again, we're told that sometimes indicators supplement law, sometimes they help law, sometimes they substitute for law, as if law is one thing, as if we know what law is, and as indicators are something else. So we have to make up our mind whether we're thinking about indicators in some way as being law, or merely as something that's going on, which people who deal with law need to know about, people who regulate need to know about. Well, it's a fact, one can't avoid them, whatever else one says, which is why it's so fascinating. Even in my own little bits of research on different topics, Transparency International, with all the criticisms one makes of it, and one wonders why it is that the top countries are either social democratic countries, like the Scandinavian countries, or they're neoliberal countries, like America, New Zealand, which are opposite in economic terms, a bit strange. And yet perhaps what they have in common is that neither are very worried about the public and the private mixing, either because the public has a very strong role in one place or because neoliberals are getting rid of the public. Italy, places like that, worry the whole time about the public and the private mixing. So they have a problem of corruption, but what is this problem, apart from what's going on in terms of people stealing things? It's also a problem of worrying about the interconnection between the public and private. So when you realize that indicators are indicators, as always with social problems, of the construction of the problem as much as of the problem itself, then the cautions that we've heard from the speakers are certainly well taken. And if you then add that the consequences of indicators are not always what one wants, it's been said that spreading transparency, showing the shaming places by showing that they are engaging in various forms of corruption in one area or another of public or social life, can sometimes have the very opposite effect. Because people can say, well, if things are as bad as that, the only way to get a job in the university is through a personal contact, I better get a personal contact and not rely on merit. I'd be a fool to rely on merit. The more you know about how something works within a system, the more you might be tempted to continue to do the same thing. After all, few of us are heroes. And so on. I could say much more about it, about the other topics I put there, but time will not allow. Just one thing about independence of judges and of prosecutors, which again there are indicators and debates about. These cross-cultural, these cross-national definitions, Italy doesn't have a very high level of judicial independence on the cross-national comparisons, but England does. But English judges until recently were appointed by a member of government, and Italian judges cause an awful nuisance to politicians because they are considered to be too independent. Can you be too independent? So these definitions across country and intrinsically, what does it mean to be independent? Independent of what? And can there be too much of a good thing? These are questions that the more you go into indicators, the more come to your mind when you know something about the topic concerned. So yes, I too am worried about them and a little suspicious about them. The Italian university is always full of people talking about Isa Duemila, who I thought was some relative of Lisa Miller. But Isa Duemila is a sort of set of rules about what you must do, otherwise your university will be punished by not being considered to be functioning properly. There has to be a place where students can put up their complaints, for example, but I wouldn't recommend it. So the fact that these things are spreading is definitely true. What we make of it is the purpose of this workshop today and tomorrow, and the continuing project being run so well by Professor Cassese and others. I just want to do two things. It's part of this aperitivo of the important thick description case studies that will come later. Set out some of the theoretical, empirical and policy questions that have come to my mind in reading some of the papers of people who've worked already in this area. I think the thing that I find lacking, with only one thing, there's so much that's wonderful, is theorizing the question I started with. Is this in some way a mutation of law? And the missing word is norms. Norms have many of these characteristics that we've been talking about. They're not produced in the correct legal way, but norms are what guide people, norms are expectations, norms are ideals. So you've got information, norms, law. And you have some major theorists, not just Latour, who is the source for many people of the importance of numbers that have already been mentioned today, but not just Latour. You have Foucault, you have Luhmann, who tell you about the processes which they refer to as normalization, capturing, as Professor Cassese does in his paper as well, talking about indicators and decrees, capturing the leaking in between these two terms of norm and normal, standard and standardization. And it's very important because often with indicators, the question that arises is, are they trying to help coordination in a complicated global system? And therefore, what's important is to do the same thing, whether it's good or bad, but at least do the same thing. Or are we talking about standard in the other sense of high expectations, human rights, as if they are universally applicable, whatever the condition, and even if in the short term that leads to less coordination. So the question of norm and normal and average and best practice I would like to put on the table. The first thing, is there a new global order? Durkheim, describing how the nation-state arose and fighting with the economists, claimed that no society can be based on exchange alone, economic exchange alone, that it depends on and produces what he called a moral order, in the sociological sense, of people having solidarity with each other. And the extent to which indicators seem to often prefigure or try to express global concerns may be part of the fact that as there's, through globalization, more and more economic interconnection, necessarily there has to be also more solidarity between people. Durkheim's argument was, and perhaps we're living through this at the moment, that if you rely only on exchange for society to work, it doesn't work. What's in my interest today, he said, will not be my interest tomorrow, prophetically, over 100 years ago. And that is key. But on the other hand, we mustn't be too aspirational, because in the actual day-to-day practice of these attempts at global ordering, the stronger states or the market, which is often in the interest of stronger states, do produce what actually happens, and it isn't just a question of a global solidarity. So some theoretical issues there, which I haven't found in the literature. Very briefly now, just through the things I have found in the literature, just to remind all of us, perhaps when we look at our particular case studies, whether some of these questions can be applied to our own research, and that will allow for better comparison between the studies of different indicators and what emerges, what are the findings. People are very interested in why they've come forward at this particular time, who these indicators are attractive to, and whether all these very different things, dealing with malaria, dealing with teenage pregnancy, dealing with bank deposits and the Basel agreements, are they really these different problems, are they similar enough that the same instruments can be used to deal with them? Or is just the fact of using the same instruments making very different types of problems more similar than they really are? And as Benedict told us, indicators don't only describe, they also constitute their notions of actors, actions, problems, diagnoses of these problems, solutions, are all inside the indicator, and they're always, almost always controversial. And then they're not the only instruments in play, so how do they relate to other instruments? I'm sure that many people will be touching in their studies on these empirical questions. They're just putting it down clear that these are questions which depend exactly on what empirical research you'll be doing. You can't be answered theoretically, we have to see. But then there are the policy questions, which are questions of what's right and wrong, which is not always just a question of empirical findings, but deciding what we want from the world. And the policy challenges is, how can you legitimate indicators? And I think they're already legitimated in two ways which are interestingly different. If there's scientific consensus about an indicator, it seems to be self-evident. If it's true, if it's a fact, it's a fact. And what makes it a fact is what scientists or experts can agree on. But an indicator may and or also need to be legitimated by the fact that you've agreed to that indicator as a standard to which you are going to comply. And then party agreement seems to be less a question of scientific consensus. What makes a standard an indicator of success and for whom? Does it depend, as in lawmaking, as we've mentioned, going through certain procedures? Or is it a matter of it works? And, of course, whether working is a good thing or not depends on the political position you're taking. So some want to resist indicators. And there are some of you who will be studying how that happens as well. And we've already seen in some of the papers I've read that at the same time there can be out there indicators which would direct emerging states, for example, in different directions. If they would go in one direction, they would introduce particular economic measures. If they would go in another direction, they would opposite. And then it's a battle between whose indicators are the ones that will win out. And we're very far from a sort of ideal new global order. We've created a form of legal pluralism at the global level to add to the existing legal pluralism that already exists. And so, to come to conclusion, in the papers I've read, and no doubt we'll be hearing in today's workshops, there are many virtues of indicators, and there are many defects of indicators. Often the very things which some people see as virtues, others see as defects. You want simplicity, and others say, you're oversimplifying. You want to get objective away from politics, and others say, you're depoliticizing. You're producing change, and others say, it's change in the wrong direction. It's displacement effect. People are busily doing things which can be measured and not more important things because they know that what will matter at the end is what is measured. Very many bureaucracies, not in Italy, I think, but very many other bureaucracies are concerned with whether they're measured and more than the actual substance of what they should be doing. Universalism, the advantage is you have some universalism, and others reply, it's a false universalism. So the virtues and defects can sometimes cancel out. Do we have a clear idea of what a good indicator would be? Is it one that has all these virtues but none of these defects? Or is that not really possible? You can't say, I want to go for the virtue of universalism if others respond, there cannot be such universalism. So there are some very difficult policy issues which indicators solve by fiat. They simply solve them to get on with things, but they're always lurking in the background. And the final point to end, assuming you want to regulate indicators, assuming you're suspicious about them, the way they're made, who they're made by, what data they have, let's say you want to regulate the making of indicators. Could you actually do it without using indicators? Are social scientists whose data supply the evidence used by indicators inside the machine and not able to stand outside it? Thank you.
Thank you so much. Then the second group of papers. The first of the second group is Ariel Colonomos, Sovereign Ratings as Normative Predictions, the Preference for a Stable Future.
Let me just start by thanking the organizers for this invitation to participate to this challenging conference and seminar. The purpose of my paper is to discuss sovereign financial ratings as what I call normative predictions. And so the two dimensions that I want to most underline in this paper is the normative dimension of ratings and therefore of indicators, and also their future-oriented dimension. That's something that comes into Benedict's definition and paper. I mean, this dual dimension of a past-oriented dimension of an indicator, and also a future-oriented dimension of an indicator. And as you know, I mean, rating agencies have been very much on the news and on the spot in the recent year, and even as for today, I mean, there's this debate about ratings about Spain. First of all, I mean, what is a rating? A rating, it's a very simple definition. A rating is an assessment of the creditworthiness of a collective entity, either a public one, such as states, and which is what I'm going to discuss in the paper, or a private one, a company. There are also indicators as rankings of the probability of default of this entity, either a business company or a state. But then, I mean, and I'm very sympathetic to the comments that were just made about social sciences, and there's also a need here to go beyond the official definition of a rating, that is the definition given by the rating agencies. The rating agencies, what it says is that the rating that it gives is an opinion about the creditworthiness of a state. Why do they say it is an opinion? Well, you're lawyers, you know why. It's because it's legally safe to say that it is an opinion, because that's freedom of opinion. But ratings are not opinions as other opinions are. They're more than just an opinion. First of all, and that's the dimension that I'm most interested in my work, there's a future-oriented, there's a forward-oriented dimension of the rating. The ratings are interpreted sometimes as predictions. The market looks at what are going to be the consequences of that rating on the future, and also the rating itself gives an indication about the future. The rating is also, and that's something that will come up in my presentation that is in the paper, the rating is a focal point in a very noisy market. That's one dimension of the indicators, is that we are surrounded by indicators. There's so many of them, hundreds, thousands, especially in the financial world. Well, rating agencies make it very simple. The ratings are very simple, A, B, C, D. And basically, there are three agencies that give ratings. They give similar ratings. It's very unlikely that those ratings agencies will diverge. So that's a very good focal point for the market. There's another dimension which is very important in the social uses of indicators, is that ratings are reputation markers. You get stuck with a reputation when you get graded, whether a good one or a bad one. And of course, economists, and I have to make it very short in the presentation, but economists talk about the negative effects of downgrade. This can be debatable. I mean, sometimes in the economic effects of the downgrade are not so powerful. However, no one wants to get a bad grade. I've never found evidence about a state which says, oh, I want to be downgraded more. So basically, it is also naming and shaming or humiliation game when you get downgraded, like in school. So the paper is on sovereign ratings. That is a ranking of states. And it's exactly, I mean, what has been so much discussed in the news over the last year, and where especially about the ratings of European countries. I'll have to skip this part, but in the paper I also have there's an historical summary of the life of those ratings and how they develop, and basically there's been a very sharp evolution of the numbers of states that have been ranked. As you see, I mean, in the 70s, there were very few, but then with the development of the junk bonds, I mean, those states, they needed to be ranked, to be on the market, on the debt market, and therefore you see the increase of the number of states that are being ranked. It's about 120 of them. You need to be ranked in order to get money on the market. And so that's why usually it's states that solicit rating agencies. They need that ranking, even if it's a bad one. So There are two dimensions that that I focus on the paper is this the forward-oriented dimension of the ranking, and then the normative one. The forward-oriented dimension is a very important one because there's here an ambiguity of the ranking. On the one hand, the ranking gives an indication about the future of the state, meaning the capacity and the intention of the state to pay its debt. So it's really about the future. But on the other hand, and that's a criticism that you can make when you think about the ratings, the data that they gather is very past-oriented. But they use this past-oriented data in order to make a claim about the future. And Standards & Poor's, well, they make it clear that it's a forward-looking opinion. When you want to get into how ratings are made, well, you can see very clearly that it's not so evident that it's so forward-oriented. The second dimension is the normative dimension, and some of these issues, I mean, Benedict in his presentation pointed at this some of these dimension. The ratings have ratings as indicators have a very normative dimension. First of all, they are a collective assessment of a collective behavior in normative terms, either good or bad. And there's a threshold when you move from good behavior to bad behavior. The second normative aspect is that ratings are, well, they are a potential sanction or reward of your behavior. That's the cost of credit. A priori, when you get a good rating, the cost of your credit will be low. If you get downgraded, potentially the cost of your credit will be higher. There's a third normative dimension, which is the fact that ratings are embedded in a series of rules and laws, and you're lawyers, you know that very well. They're embedded in a series of banking regulations. Basically, it's banks that need ratings in order to sell their products. And when they sell their products, they need to tell their investors whether this is an investment grade, whether this is investment grade or speculative grade, the bond that they sell. So they are embedded in these laws. They also reflect moral values, honesty, transparency, reliability. They're also, they also operate, and that's what I focus on the paper, under a metanorm, which is the preference for stability. And that's where I'm going to go at right away. What I argue in the paper is that basically rating agencies produce a kind of future in slow motion. They have a very conservative vision of the future. Ratings are very slow to change. Unlike the picture that you get in the news where you say, well, look, I mean, those ratings, they change their mind every time, they're so volatile, they induce such powerful effects without thinking about the consequences of what they're doing. Actually, you can make the opposite criticism. And ratings are very slow to change when they downgrade, and they're also very slow to change when they upgrade. And that's what economists have been working on, which is this pro-cyclical effect of rating agencies. So they are over-optimistic before a crisis and very pessimistic after the crisis. As you see from this graph, I mean, I hope it's not too intimidating, as Christian was saying about graphs and their users, but you see from this graph, very simple, that basically ratings are quite stable. 15% of them every year change. It's not a lot. When you think about the market that goes up and down all the time, when you think about more precise indicators, and again, reference to the comments that were just made, I mean, this is very stable. So Having said that, well, you see that ratings operate as noise reduction, as focal points for a market that needs stability. You can make the claim that, and we can talk about it in the discussion if you like, that to some extent, because they're pro-cyclical, rating agencies delay the future. There are some crises that could have happened earlier, have those ratings been more accurate. Think counterfactually. Think rating agencies as more volatile because they want to follow the market more closely. Well, then those changes would have happened earlier. Here, it is an interesting issue for those who study indicators, which is the choice that you're confronted when you are an indicator provider. And basically, that's what you were just saying about the virtues and the reason why you get criticized, which basically you can be praised and criticized for the same reason. Basically, rating agencies are confronted to a choice. Whether they are precise, and that will create a lot of turmoil by changing the rates all the time, or they're not precise, they're inaccurate, however, they're stable. And that's the trade-off that you get. And basically, the choice of the rating agencies is very clear-cut. They are stable and inaccurate. And they assume, I mean, they're very honest about that. If you have only A, B, C, D, how can you think that you can give a clear picture of what the market is with four letters? And it's a choice. And also, it's a question of legitimacy. When you are an indicator provider, in order to be legitimate, it's better to be stable. Think about someone who has to say something about the future and will change his or her mind all the time. And actually, I mean, there was a reference made to Cicero at the beginning of this conference. Well, let's look at what Cicero was saying about oracles. In his work, Divinazione, he's saying, well, oracles need to be centralized, need to be controlled, because they need to be very stable. Otherwise, they create turmoil. And basically, that's exactly what rating agencies are concerned about. And they choose stability, and therefore, they are inaccurate. That's really a choice that they make. I know that my time is out. Just maybe two points of conclusion. It is interesting to see here the politics of a very conservative industry of prediction making. And it's important to understand why there is this choice that is being made by some by an industry that has to give rankings to the global market. There's an interesting question here, which is the temporal effects of this kind of indicator. And from my perspective, temporally, I see the influence of those indicators as something that delays the future. Actually, something that delays the speed of globalization. I know that a lot of people will disagree with this and see these rating agencies as part of the sort of frenziness of the markets in the global context, but I don't think that's the case. On the contrary, they are buffers. Think about credit default swaps that are very precise measures of debt being dereferenced for the market. It will be much worse in terms of the speed and the consequences that it will have on the market. So it's sort of a speed reducer. I'm not saying this to praise rating agencies. On the contrary, I mean, they're inaccurate. They'll also make it more difficult for a country to recover, because the pace of the recovery will also be slower. But that's one of the that's to me one of the most important functions of this very specific type of industry. Then, I mean, we can talk about what can be improved and what could be the next generation of rating agencies. This is a very important topic today, politically, economically, and in the world of finance. Is there a need for a new model There's some economists and some people in finance were thinking now about some wiki ratings. You go on the internet, like in Wikipedia, and you write about the creditworthiness of an entity, and it becomes a tool for collective intelligence. People think also about futures markets. On the internet, you gather a collective intelligence on very specific issue, and you create some knowledge about future events. So those are some of the options that are on the table about a possible reform of rating agencies.
Thank you. Neal Bhutta.
Thank you. So in the time that I have available, I'd like to address certain aspects of the paper that you have in front of you, hopefully in a way to bring out some of the themes and connect them with what has been discussed so far. So in his opening remarks, Benedict observed that indicators generate power by constructing knowledge. That's an observation that I'd like to unpack a little bit in the context of the case that I've studied. But I'd also like to draw upon some of the observations that were made by Christian Arndt, because they're very much applicable to the kinds of indexes and indicators that I've been looking at. So I've been studying indexes of state failure and state fragility. And to my surprise, there are more than one might think. In the course of my research over the last couple of years, I've found over 10 purported rankings of states, ranking them by some measure of how fragile they are or what their propensity to failure is. Now, this is itself an interesting claim, because when you stop to think about what that might imply, essentially the claim is that you are measuring, quantifying nothing less than the political order of an entire territory and turning it into a number. And turning it into a number which will allow you to compare the relative propensity of failure of one state to another. Now, one of the interesting features, I think, that Christian Arndt's comments drew to our attention is that it seems that we live in a world in which there is an extraordinary demand for numbers. People want hard facts, whatever that may mean. But strikingly, I think the emergence of these indexes of state failure over the last 10 years suggests that what we're also really interested in is numbers, whether they are good or bad. There's something very attractive about numbers for some of the reasons I think that Christiana pointed to. Somehow they seem to reduce complexity. They seem to be transparent. They seem to be synthetic and synoptic, which allow us to grasp in a snapshot or in an instant a vast range of social, political, and economic phenomena. One of the things that I'd like to bring out in my comments is the extent to which this appearance of synthesis, this appearance of transparency, actually is deeply misleading. Numbers of this scale, numbers which purport to rank a vast terrain of political and social organization and turn them into a single integer, it can never really be terribly accurate. But what's interesting is that seems to have absolutely no consequence on whether we'd like them or use them. There's the demand for them. So one of the first observations I'd like to bring out of this story is that there does seem to be a great increase in demand for ways of reducing complexity. And in particular, what we seem to be interested in is improving our ability to make claims about vastly dissimilar social and political spaces, to be able to compare things easily. Right. So this is what anthropologist Sally Engel-Mary, who's one of the collaborators on this project with Benedict and Kevin Davis, calls a knowledge effect, which is to be able to make a claim of knowledge without necessarily knowing terribly much about the differences between places. And that's a very, very important effect of the demand for hard facts. It's a demand for an appearance of simple comparability. Now, this is an interesting feature of the story of the rise of indexes of state failure and state fragility. The paper that I submitted to the program is focusing on one specific index, which is produced annually by the United States Agency on International Development. As I said, there are a number of others. I'd like to focus on this one. Many of the, I think, observations that I have about this one apply equally to other indexes, but I'm not going to try and work them all through. USAID, which is essentially the official development arm of the United States government, develops an interest in ranking around the same time or shortly after the events of September 11. In the context of those events, unsurprisingly, there was a great deal of interest in trying to figure out which states are more or less likely to suffer from some sort of catastrophic failure of governance, a sort of collapse of public institutions. And of course, here the archetype is Afghanistan and Somalia. But in the aftermath of September 11 attacks, there's a clear connection or association with particular kinds of threats to national security emanating from what the Defense Department at the time called ungoverned spaces. So as one of the officials that I interviewed in Washington some time ago put it, for aid agencies, this seemed to be something of a golden opportunity to get diplomats and defense ministries interested in development. And from 2003 onwards, almost all of the major development agencies of the Western world adopted a concept called fragility, which was really a theory of the state. Right? What is it that makes a state more or less likely to political disorder and other kinds of crisis? So USAID from 2005 onwards develops an ambitious program of aid, which is aimed at what they consider to be the addressing the sources and the causes of state fragility. Whether we have a clear definition of that concept is another matter. But their interest in ranking derives from two sources. One is they would like to use a ranking, an indicator, to help them allocate resources. Which states are more fragile than others? And therefore, where should we send our money? But in addition, they'd like to use the index, this numerical quantitative tool, as a way of identifying what the sources of fragility are for a given state. And so if you accept the idea that the purpose of aid programming should be to address the causes of state fragility, because this will both serve a security function, but also in the parlance of most of the aid agencies at the time, is also essential to improving human development. You must have a well-functioning, non-fragile state to achieve these aims. You really need to know what the problem is. What's the source of fragility? So interestingly, I think for our purposes here, in 2005, as they formulated this project, USAID decided that an index, a form of quantification, was the way to go to help deal with this programmatic problem. And the index would decide whether Sierra Leone was more fragile than Zimbabwe, right? And it would also help decide whether the sources of fragility in Sierra Leone had to do with legitimacy or effectiveness of the state. So as you can see, I think just by this sort of very, very brief introduction to the concept of an indicator of state fragility or an index of state fragility, we are speaking of things that are very difficult to measure. How does one measure legitimacy of the state? How does one measure the effectiveness of a state? And indeed, what exactly is one measuring when one purports to measure the state? As a British sociologist put it more than 30 years ago, the state is an inherently ideological thing. To represent the state as a collection of institutions or something that successfully discharges certain functions is in a certain way to limit our understanding of what actually makes a state relatively resilient or not. So one of the striking things about the production of this number, which is a rank ordering produced annually by USAID and circulated to United States government officials. It's not a public index, but it's that has apparently quite a wide circulation within the American government, is that specific political histories, trajectories, institutional pathways, political and social cultures must in some way be turned into one number. How do you do that? What do you measure? What do you look at? How do you know what is a good proxy for one or the other thing? So this is the sense in which the hard fact, right, that the fact that in 2010 Cameroon ranked as more fragile than Sierra Leone, this hard fact which the numbers seem to show, is of course a deeply theoretical thing. It requires a very elaborate theoretical infrastructure in order to generate this seemingly portable, transparent number. And one of the things that it requires is a theory of the state, and actually a very thick theory of the state. Because in order to claim to measure the propensity of a state towards fragility or failure, one must somehow, or at least I think in principle, one must claim to know what features of a state, what institutional, political, economic, and social features of a state incline it towards strength or weakness. So a theory of fragility or a theory of state strength is actually a deeply normative theory of the state. In the paper, I unpack this claim. It's difficult to do because it's a fairly detailed study. But one of the key things, interesting observations, I think, is that the rise of this number, or the rise of the production of this kind of a number, goes hand in hand with the dominance of a particular kind of theory of the state. And it relies upon other indicators, other sources of data, which embed their own theories of the state. So returning to Christiane Arndt's observation, when the Good Governance or the Governance Matters Indexes first came out, there was a great deal of debate about whether they were measuring anything at all. In a sense, their domestication, their constant use and iteration seems to give them a hard quality renders the methodological debate somewhat abstract or insignificant. One of the interesting features about the indexes of state failure, both the USAID and others that I've looked at, is that they then aggregate earlier aggregations. They construct a theory of the state and then purport to measure it by using existing data sources that claim to measure other aspects of states. So you can already see here a fairly complex pyramid emerging. The number, the rank ordering is at the top, 1, 2, 3, all the way through to 161. I think in the year that I looked at, Italy was placed at 157, which meant it was a relatively stable state as far as USAID was concerned. But beneath that singular number, there's an extraordinary iceberg of data sets, theoretical claims, unresolved and untested theoretical propositions about the relationship between institutions and political order. And none of these things are resolved theoretically in the construction of the index. They are simply passed. So just to conclude, because I know my time is up, I'd just like to, I guess, make an observation, which I think the study of these particular indexes helps us grapple with. One is that there is an extraordinary demand for this kind of distributed cognition. We want to be able to compare widely very, very complex things. Whether or not the comparison is any good is secondary to the need to compare. And that seems to be driven by a set of processes that are closely connected to the ambition of global governance, whether or not that's the reality of global governance. The second observation, which I think is true of this index but also of others, is that what you are left with is a chain of inferences which go from the bottom of the pyramid, the various disassembled data sets, the different theoretical claims, which are then stripped of any uncertainty, any ambiguity which is inherent in the data set, and solidified and turned into a seemingly solid number at the top. So the inference is what is passed on up to the top of the chain. Whether the inference is any good at each step of the chain is a separate question. So the sort of various process of world-making, judgment-calling, prototyping that go into the production of each of these data sets is erased. All of the theoretical claims or preoccupations you might have about the governance indicators disappears once they are rolled into another aggregation which purports to measure the quality of governance generally. So the third observation that I'd like to make is to use a concept from Bruno Latour, which is the concept of a panorama. These kinds of global scale indexes, which seem to be so much in demand, function as panoramas. They purport to allow us to see everything from a great height. But as we know, real panoramas were very deceptive. They were a trompe l'œil. They did not show us everything, but they purported to. And I think one of the things that we need to be thinking about, or at least be investigating further, is why is there such a demand for these panoramas that stitches together very different genres, political theory, quantification, claims about economic growth, and turns them into some kind of singular perspective. That's the allure of the number. That's its simplifying effect. But that's precisely why it can never really be accurate. Thank you.
Thank you. The last paper of this session, Sabino Cassese, Lorenzo Casini on public regulation of global indicators. Lorenzo presents the...
Okay. What you see in this picture is not a graph, you can see them, and this is not because we are moving to astrology according to the normative prediction of indicators. This is only one of the several examples of how ancient indicators are, because pyramids and tombs have been considered as one of the most important social indicators. Archaeologists have been able to map the structure of entire societies using funerary indicators and funerary remains. Now, this is another evidence that public authorities have been kept over control, over management of weight and measures since centuries. As Benedict Kingsbury and David Nelken and other speakers have already shown, indicators are spreading globally, and international organizations take a growing number of important decisions by relying on indicators. This is why, and David Nelken has pointed out quite clearly, the question of how to regulate the production and use of indicators has emerged, triggering other questions regarding accountability and legitimacy. Our paper analyzes the process of regulating global indicators. And we claim that indicators can display an intrinsic regulatory nature, but not all of them require a regulatory framework to ensure legitimacy and accountability. Second, the determination as to whether or not a framework is needed depends on several factors, such as type of indicators, characteristics of its producers, and different users involved. Now, let's give an example, knowing that the main questions we have to address is if indicators represent a technology of global governance, should they be subjected to regulation or not? Now, the problem is that these questions requires many answers. And the case of credit rating agencies that Ariel Kolomonos has just shown presents already four different approaches to address these main questions. Now, the first is that ratings should be protected by free speech, as you had just mentioned. They are opinion, so if they are opinions, they should remain free from regulation. And this is what happened in the US until recently. Second approach, producers should be put under the control of legislation, and this is what happened in the US after an initial approach regarding the possibility of considering ratings as free from regulation, and it happened in the EU in the 2009-2010 reform. But there is also a third approach based on the fact that neither producers nor the indicators should be subjected to regulation. but the process by which indicators are produced should be regulated. And this is here where administrative law principles, such as transparency, participation, review, can be very helpful. But we have also a fourth approach. Indicators themselves must be regulated or produced by public authorities. So you see here that a single problem, trying to answer a single question, has been solved with four different approaches. This is why we believe that in order to try to answer to the main question, it's quite important to differentiate and to distinguish categories of indicators. Now, we claim that differences in production processes and uses allow the identification of two main categories of indicators, binding and voluntary. Of course, indicators can be used in more than one of these modes. They can overlap, and you can see sometimes the same indicators that is binding in one case but becomes voluntary in another one. So let's try to see quickly these two categories of indicators. Binding indicators, those are imposed on or applied to regulatives by states, IOs, or other global institutions. They could be either public or private, such as in the case of Global Fund, for example. This means that the regulatees do not choose these indicators, but they are often compelled to adapt their behavior or operations in order to demonstrate good performance or compliance with the standards disseminated through such indicators. There are two different types of binding indicators. Probably there are more, because of course empirical analysis might show even much, much more categories, but we try at least to differentiate binding indicators into two different types. The first regards indicators produced by regulators and imposed on or applied to regulatees, such as in the case of the World Bank indicators. Now, and this is already a possible answer to the main question, they simply represent another kind of regulatory intervention. So they are as legitimate as the institutions that produce them. But there is a second type, a type of indicators used by third parties. So this means that not the producer, not the regulatee on the party addressed by the indicators are the parties to evaluate the regulatees. So the indicators are used to evaluate the regulatees, but by third parties, such as in the case of OECD PISA indicators on student evaluation. They are used by public authorities to assess their systems, but they are produced by a different institution. This creates a problem of legitimacy, or it might create it, because the legitimacy of these indicators cannot be derived from that of its producer, because the user is not the producer. So, now, going to voluntary indicators, the first main difference is that voluntary indicators are chosen. And we have two main hypotheses here. The first one is that indicators can be used by the regulatees themselves in a process of voluntary compliance as a means of self-coordination. This is what happens with the human development indicators. But there is a second case where indicators can be used by third parties to influence other third parties. This is what happens, for instance, in the NGOs referring to the ratings produced by Freedom House Index. Now, if indicators are freely chosen by the regulatees, apparently, the legitimacy concern should not arise because of consensus. So, what is the first conclusion about the main questions we try to address? That if we look at binding indicators, we see that if it is the regulator itself who produces the indicators, there is no need for special regulation. Indicators will follow the rules set forth for a specific field of activity. And in these cases, rulemaking procedures should, of course, be transparent, especially with respect to the criteria underlying or supporting the indicator at issue. If, however, an indicator that is produced by one institution is then used by another institution in evaluating a third party, then the need for a legal framework emerges. And this is the case of OECD PISA indicators. In both cases, in any event, problem of the judicial review of science-based measures taken by public administration arises, because we have decisions relying on technical and science expertise who can create problems in the scope of judicial review over this kind of decision. Now, going to the voluntary indicators, If compliance is based on consensus, there may not be a need for regulation. But there can be cases in which third parties create pressures on states or international organizations to adopt the standards contained in and disseminated through indicators. What we try to see and to demonstrate is that in the case of voluntary indicators, sometimes the voluntary is only a label that can hide more complex system in order to ensure compliance. And sometimes it's quite easy to see a voluntary indicator transformed into a binding indicators, even if formally it shouldn't be like that. So this is the end, you see, just a warning. This is one of the most famous verse by William Shakespeare, and even will be in 1 week summer, we are already in a nice weather. But be aware that indicators and measurement can be hidden everywhere, even here, because this is also one of the most famous iambic pentameter ever written. Thank you.
Thank you. The second discussant, Stefano Battini.
The three papers that I've been requested to comment take different approaches. The paper presented by Cassese and Cassini takes a more general approach, and it sets out a taxonomy of different types of indicators in order to determine in which cases a need of public regulation of indicator arises. The other papers take a more specific approach, as long as they both focus on a single type of indicator. However, the object of the type of indicator referred to by Buta is very broad in itself, namely the stateness, considered as a product of the legitimacy and the effectiveness of state institutions. And indicators of these dimensions of stateness can measure, a contrario, the fragility of a state. The specific indicator taken into account by Kolonomos does not expressly measure the fragility of states, but it certainly reveals the fragility of states as far as access to credit represents a precondition for the legitimacy and effectiveness of many states, including, unfortunately, Italy. My first comment is that I learned many things from reading the papers. This is not to say that they are excellent if you consider that I didn't know much about indicators before. However, I do think that they are excellent. And I will organize my comments simply by listing four things that I have learned and by making some questions for each thing. The things I learned refer to the following topics. First, the definition of indicator. Second, the relationship between indicators and globalization. Third, the relationship between indicators and legitimacy. And finally, the relationship between accuracy of indicators and their widespread use. So, first point, what is an indicator? Lawyers perhaps like too much definitions. However, in this case, a definition could be necessary because the concept of indicator is the very starting point of our research project. What are we looking for? We are looking for all things that could be defined as indicator. So the papers could suggest at least the following elements for a provisional definition of indicator. First, indicators are basically measurements of some phenomena to which they refer. Second, indicators also involve assessments of the phenomena which they purport to measure. Assessment often expressed by comparisons and rankings. Third, indicators are predictions. According to Kolonomos, credit rating agencies are modern oracles. And according to Buta, indicators of fragility of states are directed to measure the likely risk of future instability. Fourth, indicators are simplifications. As Buta perfectly explains, The numbers stand in for a judgment about a complex social reality. Fifth, indicators are rules. According to Casini and Cassese, indicators can have an intrinsic regulatory nature. Sixth, indicators imply sanctions, such as the downgrading of sovereign credit ratings. So my first question is the following. According to Aristotle, a definition must indicate the essence of the object to be defined. And so are all these elements listed before essential in the definition of indicator, or are some of them in Aristotelic terms accidental? In other words, I wonder whether some of the elements listed before could be linked only to specific indicators or to the particular context in which such specific indicators are applied and used, rather than to the very concept of indicator. The second thing I learned regards the relationship between indicator and globalization. All the papers highlight such relationship, arguing that the spread of indicators is linked to globalization for several reasons. Firstly, globalization puts into communication different legal and economic systems, and therefore indicators are useful as measuring and comparing instruments. Secondly, globalization requires uniformity, and therefore indicators are useful as normative and regulatory instruments in order to harmonize domestic policies. Thirdly, globalization increases risks, and therefore indicators are useful as predictive instruments. However, many of the components of our provisional definition of indicator could hardly be considered as a new function entrusted to international organizations because of globalization. As Cassese and Cassini have pointed out, public authorities, and particularly international organizations, have been measuring and numbering for centuries. And international organizations have regularly been collecting and distributing information, giving opinions, making recommendations, etc. Such functions, however, have long been perceived as soft powers. And now globalization has introduced a strong interest of each state in the kind of information evaluation and ratings, referring to the state itself, which are circulated in the global community and on which other states and private investors rely for choices which can affect the national community. Thus, globalization can explain why a very old and once harmless international function has become, in a different and more globalized context, a very effective form of power with a hard impact. If this is true, my question is, what is the real source of the power exercised by indicators? Does the power reside in the instrument itself, or does it come from the context in which it is applied? Does the power belong to the subject providing indicators or to the subjects using indicators? It belongs to the oracle or to the people consulting the oracle. The third thing I learned refers to the relationship between indicators and legitimacy. And first of all, I learned that such relationship runs in both ways. For example, Casini and Cassese focus on legitimacy of indicators, while Buta focuses on indicators of legitimacy. Therefore, we could be tempted to measure the legitimacy of indicators by indicators, namely by the indicators of legitimacy examined by Buta. Indicators of legitimacy generally refer, among others, to a key dimension, which is accountability and participation. For example, in the strategy paper of the United States Agency for International Development, mentioned by Buta, an important legitimacy indicator is the voice and accountability, which is produced by the World Bank and which measure the extent to which citizens of a country are able to participate in the selection of governments. If we would apply this legitimacy indicator to the production of indicators of state performance, we should measure, for example, the extent to which states whose sovereign debts are rated are able to participate in the selection of the credit rating agencies. Yet such participation would probably reduce rather than enhance the legitimacy of the credit rating agencies, because for investors, the crucial dimension of legitimacy is their independence rather than their accountability. So my question on this point is simple. If indicators are to be subjected to public regulation in order to ensure their legitimacy, what should be the purpose of such regulation? Participation or independence? Accountability or impartiality? The fourth and last thing that I learned refers to the relationship between accuracy of indicators and their success. As Cassese and Casini point out, indicators can derive authority from their accuracy. And it would appear perfectly reasonable to state that a specific indicator is so much successful in terms of its widespread use as it is deemed to be an accurate measurement of the phenomenon to which it refers. On the contrary, the papers suggest that this is often not the case. Buta's paper clearly illustrates that the USAID indicators of state legitimacy and effectiveness are anything but accurate. And Kolonomos goes even further, noting that ratings are successful regardless of their accuracy. They don't need to be accurate as they perform a different function, which is stability. There is a need, I'm quoting Kolonomos, there is a need for stable predictions whose main concern is not accuracy. And this is a very important point and raises a couple of final questions. First, are indicators widespread as long as they are deemed to be accurate? Or on the contrary, are indicators deemed to be accurate as long as they are widespread? And second, could a possible competition between different indicators measuring the same phenomena increase their accuracy and their value, as Cassese and Casini point out? Or on the contrary, would such competition undermine stability? Because according to Kolonomos, I'm still quoting, divergences between ratings would hurt the rating system as such, encouraging and reinforcing mistrust vis-à-vis their methodology. So whatever the answers, I think that the questions raised by these excellent papers are definitely very important, and the research project on the indicators deserves to continue and to develop further as part of the more general research project on global administrative law. Thank you.
Thank you, Stefano. Then we can have now a discussion, and we have about 40 minutes. Then if everybody who speaks not more than 5 minutes, we can have 7 or 8 contributes. Then we wants begin. Matthias.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure for me to be here. I've got 2 questions. The first question concerns the paper by Lorenzo and Professor Cassese. And the second, I'll start with the first question. I find your question really tackles one of the key problems which lawyers have when they're talking about indicators. What is the problem for lawyers when they talk about indicators? Indicators are something which lawyers are not used to deal with because their focus is normally on law as the only authoritative instrument that matters for them. This has a long history, and Foucault tells us why this came to be the case. In early modernity, I think law had such an appeal. It had this appeal to justice, to natural law, to even divine law, that it was considered as a legitimate form for the exercise of power of the new rising absolutist leaders. And so they sticked to law, or making people believe that law was the only thing through which they're governed. And that is, I think, to some extent, why we're still so much focused on the law. We're not focused on the information, but we all know that information plays a very huge role, and then the question is how to tackle it. Foucault says that we need to cut off the head of the king in our political thinking, but he doesn't really tell us how, and I think Lorenzo and Professor Casey made a very useful attempt with your categorization. What is it what really matters? And you distinguish between binding and voluntary indicators. And I ask myself, is that the solution to where we should make the threshold of public authority? I hesitate a little bit to agree with you, because we had the same experience with soft law. It turned out that the distinction between binding and voluntary legal norms is sometimes really problematic. And I think one of the reasons why we have the global administrative law movement is that we saw that soft law is also quite effective. There's reputational sanctions, there's incentives, there's groupthink, there's all these things which make it effective. And I think a lot of that also applies to voluntary indicators. So my question to you is, how can we really define that lower threshold of public authority? Where do we need to draw the line? And I think it needs to be somewhere between binding, on the sliding scale between binding indicators, as you call them, and completely voluntary indicators. Second question goes to Christiane and maybe also to Ariel. I might be wrong, but if I understood you correctly, you were somehow telling us that there is this huge demand for indicators of governments who really want to know something about the world, and that they really are somehow innocent, maybe even naive in approaching you and believing that indicators, ratings, whatever, would tell them the truth. And again, going back to Foucault, I'm not so sure whether I would buy that story, because Foucault shows how deliberate governments make use of information and of indicators. And I would like to ask you, what is, in your experience, Christiane, maybe to the extent you're able and willing to tell, what is the reason for this move to objectivity? Isn't it that there is very often a very clear government agenda behind it, and that they don't mind, as Nihal said, that there are no really good indicators, that there is no good data? Same with Aria. What is the reason for these credit ratings? I mean, the importance of credit ratings is not a result of credit rating agencies' own activities, but it is the result of a deliberative regulatory choice to give credit rating agencies this position. Why is that so? Why is there this demand for crude, just unconvincing, empirically problematic data, which is so backwardish and not looking and not really telling governments what they want to be told? Thank you.
Thank you.
I want to go back to David Nelken's question, which was, why have global indicators emerged? And I want to go back to this question because I find there is an ambiguity of in the papers presented up to now. Because some papers are focused on global indicators, some on indicators. And I would like to try to answer the question, are there peculiarities in the production and use of global indicators, in using and producing indicators for the global space? Why do I want to underline this difference? Because I find that indicators are developing inside nations for a very simple reason. That is, the development of indicators is a chapter of the transition from public opinion to public measurement. We have more and more a monetary democracy. We have more and more indicators, think tanks, surveys. And those are power scrutinizing devices. And those power scrutinizing devices are important for national democracy, but not important in the global space. First of all, because you don't have public opinion, and second, because you don't have democracy. So therefore, the indicators are important in the national setting for a reason which is quite different from the reason for developing public indicators in the global space. Now, let me try to put on the table four good reasons for developing global indicators, indicators in the global space. Now, the first one is that comparing by numbers is very important. If you compare France and Italy, is easy. But if you compare more than three countries, you need indicators. So indicators are a very useful instrument of comparison. Of course, you can compare, for instance, demand of justice, but there is a drawback that you cannot compare the context. So here, the question is, can we develop more indicators in order to have a better comparison? So this is one reason why indicators are important outside nations, outside one country. The second reason is horizontal accountability. As horizontal accountability plays a very important role, indicators become important because they are a typical horizontal measure. Imagine President Obama calling Frau Merkel, or imagine the European Commission calling the Greek government. How can they discuss without having indicators? I mean, they can put conditions. I mean, the European Commission can put a condition on the Greek government only at the condition that they have indicators, one, and second, that they can compare indicators. So therefore, indicators are the basic infrastructure for developing a dialogue which is the basis of what is called now, widely called, the horizontal accountability, not the vertical accountability, governors or governing bodies to the people, but one government to another government and to another government and to a supranational government. So this is the second possible reason of developing global indicators. Third, indicators are good for reducing risks. Now, we know that in the global space that there's not a global order. If there is not one global order, there is no certainty. And the problem is to reduce uncertainty. Let me give you an example. Many Italian entrepreneurs, firms, they are locating their plants in other countries. They need to know how much they pay labor in those countries. So they need indicators. They need indicators like the doing business indicators. And they need indicators in order to take decisions which are important for them. And of course, from this point of view, the institution which produced indicators, like rating agencies, they are as important as national parliaments. I mean, the rating agencies are now taking budgetary decisions which are important for the Italian budget, much more than the Italian parliament. That's a crucial point. And because this point is crucial, it is crucial the point of legitimacy. Who takes care of this? Who is going to regulate those decisions which are as important as the budgetary decisions of the Italian parliament? And my final point, which is more less clear, I think, is that let me see which was the final point. Yes, that the indicators can be produced not only by states but also by private parties, and therefore they in a way are open to the public. So in the global space there are producers of indicators which are public authorities, national governments, and there are producers of indicators which are private. And the problem is the competition among them and the possibility of having an authority which regulates something which is covered by the free speech in the US, not in the in Europe. So to go back to my central point, I think it is important to take care of you see the topic of our discussion, which is indicators in the global governance, not of indicators as such, but indicators in global governance. Why are they important in the global governments? Which are the peculiarities of using and producing indicators in the global space?
Thank you, Kevin. Davis.
Hi. I just wanted to highlight the importance of distinguishing the predictive indicators that were the focus of Ariel Colonimus's paper and also, to some extent, Nihal Bhutta's, because they are actually quite different animals from a lot of the other indicators that we study. I mean, in the paper that Benedict and Sally and I wrote, we talk sometimes about indicators reflecting and simplifying a complex social reality, but of course these predictive indicators are not reflecting reality, they're trying to predict the future, and so that's quite different. So I think these indicators, these predictive indicators, have distinct forms of demand, right? They're not necessarily of use for, say, social scientific purposes, for trying to figure out what happened in the past and why and so forth. They're used more for commercial purposes, or perhaps for regulatory purposes to try to influence what's going to happen, but they're not used for the sort of scientific purposes that some other indicators are used. And they also have a distinctive impact. And I think this is something that Ariel perhaps could have focused on more. It's sort of implicit in what you're saying, but this idea that the ratings, that particular set of indicators, they don't just follow the market more or less closely. To a certain extent, they actually move the market, right? And that matters. So if Italy is downgraded by the rating agencies, that will not just that's not just an assessment of how likely it is that Italy is going to repay its debts in the future, but that might actually influence the ability of Italy to repay its debts in the future, because then it'll be more costly for the government to issue bonds, government spending will contract, the economy will contract, and then it will certainly be difficult to fund the economy. So there is that endogeneity of these predictive indicators. When they attain a certain level of prominence, that's not a feature of some of the other indicators. These don't just reflect reality, but they actually shape reality that they purport to measure, right? So that I think is quite significant. In other words, they might become self-fulfilling predictions, right? So that's a possibility at least. And trying to figure out which indicators attain that status is an interesting line of inquiry. It may not require regulation, actually. There may be situations where you have an indicator that so monopolizes the market, even in the absence of a regulation, that it is equally influential. So that's something else. And I think, thinking about these predictive indicators, we sometimes evaluate indicators in terms of their reliability, but that doesn't necessarily make sense when we're talking about a predictive indicator that can actually shape the future. The reliability might have a different meaning in this context. And when we're thinking about how to regulate them, again, if these indicators are indicators that really are self-fulfilling prophecies, maybe we shouldn't be focusing so much on the technical details of their construction, because that's not what really gives them their power. It just should be maybe their legitimacy, who's appointed, who's staffing these rating agencies and so forth, as opposed to the technical details of their models. So those are just some random thoughts, but just to highlight the fact that these are really a different category of indicators, and they merit, I think, their own distinctive form of analysis.
Thank you. Giulio Napolitano.
Yes, I would like to raise a methodological point. Up to a certain extent, as it often happens in the early stage of a new science, legal scholars start with a positivistic approach. And maybe we are still in a positivistic era also in the study of indicators. I mean, we are focusing our efforts on typology, effects, legitimacy, or alternative regulatory models. But I was wondering if we could try in the future a gradual shift towards what I would call a post-positivist or post-modern legal theory of indicators. And I would try to label this shift with the name of the indicators game. In a certain way, it seems to me that the indicators game is a strategic game in which indicators producers, indicators victims, and indicators users act and react each other. At the first stage, indicators are produced and published, and indicated or measured actors and institution have to decide how to react to the indicators and to their to the publishment of these results. In this decision, in a certain way, they have to compare, as always, the benefits of trying to better their ranking with the costs deriving from that. So not always indicators can shape or change the behavior of the measured actors. It's a problem of costs. Sometimes, if costs of compliance are too high, measured actors and institutions can prefer to maintain the bad ranking. Another strategy, of course, is false or apparent or formal compliance with indicators and parameters. We had many examples of that. One specific issue is what I would call the unintended consequences of indicators or the unintended effects of indicators. Sometimes, even if there is compliance and effective compliance, the problem may be another. Indicators induce compliance with them rather than efficiency or good performance if these values are not precisely met in the indicators. Finally, indicators users must decide whether to rely on indicators or not, and sometimes they can try to take advantage of the indicators' results. An example is when they try to increase and take benefit of their contractual power over the badly measured actors, like in credit-debt relations. This is, of course, just the first stage of the game, and this is, as always, a never-ending game, because at the beginning of the new cycle of the second round, producers of indicators must evaluate whether to change or not indicators and parameters in order to better address all the problems that were raised at the first stage. And if we give a look to the changes and amendments in the Stability and Growth Pact, which is a very peculiar normative prediction or parameter or normative value, we can have a very precise idea of the way indicators producers react to good and bad behaviors of measured actors. So this is my final comment. If we take into proper considerations
all the actions and reactions of all the involved actors in the indicators game, we could have perhaps a better understanding of the phenomena and also an alternative approach to the legal problems, because legal problems are not only related to legitimacy, but also to the issue of governing, ruling all the strategic behaviors of the different actors.
Thank you, Itai Apter.
Thank you. Just two short questions, and mainly to the presentation made by Christian, but also to the maybe to the other panelists, is what do you believe is the importance of the effect of developing an indicator on the internal public debate or political debate in the state or in the governed jurisdiction? And in that, if we can use the OECD example and to give the Israeli example, since joining the OECD 2 years ago, I think that every week there is a new study published by the OECD, and maybe it's to the credit of Christian and others in the organization that these studies receive very, I don't know how it is in other countries, but they receive a great deal of attention. And the PISA example is a very relevant one. And each indicator, and supposedly this could be the case in other states, raises a lot of very wide public debate, usually coming from NGOs or from opposition parties, which are basing their data on the data provided by the OECD. And not only the OECD, as the OECD issue develops, then other indicators also receive great prominence in public debate. And in that context, the question is, do you think that this could possibly have a disincentive effect on governments or on those who, on policymakers to act according to indicators? And in that sense, when should there come a time, and maybe that's a question for all the panelists, maybe other than the credit agency example, when the international organization or the producer, provider of an indicator decides that certain issues are not, should not be, should not have an indicator focus on them. And we can think about examples, for example, in the area of defense or in the area, or in other very sensitive areas when then developing indicators can be counterproductive. And in this matter, I think we should all think of whether there could come a time when there are too many. Of course, there's a demand for indicators. When there are so many indicators, then that their relevance and their effectiveness decreases with the continuation of their development. And the one last thing, also important, is how should international organizations or producers of indicators neutralize their own interest in developing the indicator? Meaning that if an organization it develops an indicator only for the purpose of visibility, and of course that's maybe legitimate, but I think that this should also be taken into account when thinking about how to regulate or how to provide more legitimacy to indicators. Thank you.
Thank you. We have Rene Ruegna and then Mauro Bussani.
Thanks. Yeah, very briefly, I was going back to Mattia's question. I was really wondering, and perhaps if Lorenzo or Professor Casas could help us out with this one. I really wonder whether the way to look at this problem of the regulation and the law, non-law question of indicators is really either with the dichotomical view of binding, non-binding, or even with this sliding scale that you were proposing. Because, I mean, if you really think about it, it's not really that there are indicators that are binding and others that are non-binding, but rather that one same indicator has different impacts depending on the context where it is received. And in that sense, I'm also wondering whether this division between global and non-global indicators would would have that much use in this context, because perhaps a purely domestic indicator, say for instance USAID's indicator on failed states, what Nihal Buta was talking about, perhaps this one has a global impact in the sense that it shapes behavior outside the normal jurisdiction where the state of the United States would have influence or would have formal jurisdiction. So the question then would be whether, if we don't think about them in this way of binding and non-binding, whether then we have to think of a different way about regulation, which brings me to the question that I wanted to ask to Professor Nelken, who was arguing whether, so perhaps indicators are law. So you were saying, we're thinking about it, and I found very interesting what you were saying. You were saying, look, we're thinking about regulation of indicators in the sense that indicators are there and they are not law, and we think that law regulates them. And you were saying, look, but that depends on the definition of law that we have. Perhaps indicators are law. If we have, let's say, a wider, more sociological, let's say, definition of law. But then I was wondering, if we think about it that way, the question would be, so what? I mean, so let's say they are law. So what do we do with that? I think it's a very powerful insight, but then I don't know what to do with that. Then would that mean that then we don't regulate them anymore? Would that mean that they are inherently legitimate? Or that they, you know, they have this inherent binding power, and then that means something? So that's something that I don't know what to make of that insight in concrete.
Thank you. Mauro Bussani.
Very few remarks halfway between caveats and questions. I think that whenever we speak of indicators, we should be aware of many, many things, and most of them, many of them have been reasoned by the speakers and discussed and so far. But I think also that there's a difference in nature of indicators that should be addressed, because these differences entail a list of questions that I'd like to be addressed during this seminar. I think that it should be clear that there are indicators based on comparative and possibly failed research that are scientific issues, scientific products. There are indicators that are based on gathering answers to questionnaires, more or less detailed, more or less close-ended. And then there are indicators that gathers sentiments, as the international language goes on it, sentiments inferred from answers to different kind of questionnaires. And I think that these are indicators very different in nature, and to be assessed at least under the scientific point of view, at least in the scholarly perspective, very differently. The second caveat slash remark slash question is about legitimacy. I think that I agree with Giulio Napolitano, at least up to a certain extent. I am aware that there are indicators that are very important on the scientific space, on the scientific market, on the market of ideas. And there are indicators that are very important because they have a political impact, because they influence political perceptions, political debates, and ultimately, sometimes, legal reforms. And some of these indicators aim to produce legal reforms. But either way, I don't see the legitimacy issue as a crucial issue. Because either these indicators are used on a voluntary basis, as Sabino Cassese and Lorenzo Casini reminded us of, so at least in principle there should be no issue of legitimacy, or these indicators or the outcomes of these indicators in political and legal terms are imposed by a source whose legitimacy to do so is either clear, established, acknowledged, or does it become the true issue to be addressed? Not so, therefore, the legitimacy of the source imposing the indicators or the outcomes of the indicators, not the indicators themselves or the indicators producers themselves. Finally, for the time being, I'd like to stress that instead of legitimacy, I'm much more concerned about, in this field too, about accountability. The scientific market, the scientific arena, is an arena where reputation is the key asset. Up to a certain extent, the political arena can be defined the same way, with the proviso that, of course, whenever a legal reform is nationally adopted on the eve of that or that indicator or on the wake of that or that rank-seeking attitude, voters and constituencies at the national level can always check the desirability of these reforms. But whenever indicators have also an economic impact, and this is often the case, the accountability issue should be placed at the forefront of the debate. That's why I'm not sure that I have correctly understood and Ariel Colon-Amos when he traces his own line about credit rating agencies that I don't challenge, even if I do not agree. But the point is that he's making the point that they are issuing normative predictions. It is that I would agree with you on this specific point, but this is very hard to match with an overall and worldwide attitude, especially in the United States, to deal with this, with the ratings, as mere opinion covered by the First Amendment, and then letting rating agencies go scot-free from any civil liability. And the Dodd-Frank Act, by the way, did not improve really or very much the situation. So I think to go to the end of this already long intervention, that whenever we have an economic impact falling out of the use of indicators, accountability issue should be placed at the forefront. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Is it 4:26? Then I propose to close this session to take our coffee break. What is coffee break, Lorenzo?
We have to go to the library that is on this floor, so we just have to walk down and go straight.
Thank you.